Join Johannes, a necromancer of some little infamy, and his charismatic brother Horst in the many adventures of the Cabal brothers on the Necromancer's Deathcast. From circuses to dreamlands in turn-of-the-century Never Never England, author Jonathan L. Howard brings his dry wit and exceptionally clever writing to this series of the most intense and tumultuous proportions. Rise up, all ye undead, and rejoice in the wonder that is the Necromancer's Deathcast.
Welcome to the Necromancer's Deathcast, brought to you by Free Flow Rambling. This is episode 3.3, The Thing from the Crypt, where we are discussing the book Johannes Cabal, The Necromancer. My name is Tanzin, and I'm joined by Amber.
Hello.
And Jess.
Hi.
Chapter 3. Johannes Cabal takes a trip to the Druin family tomb in the Grimpen burial grounds to release a creature from the crypt, in hopes that he will receive the help that he needs to run his carnival. And here he finds a surprising, yet very familiar, ally.
Commandeered crypts.
Burial. It's a personal choice.
There are, of course, those who don't care to be buried at all, but prefer to be burnt or left in the open open for vultures to pick at, or something equally unhygienic.
They are of no concern here. Great intro to the next chapter, of course. Starts off strong. I think, actually, I heard you say at one point that you felt like this chapter in itself was like sort of a, what do you call it, a short story unto itself in a lot of ways?
Yeah, a short story within a short story.
It really is. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get a whole other family's backstory for no other reason than
setting fun. The stage.
Yeah. It's almost like when you read a Shakespeare play and it starts with like a quick sonnet that just gives away the entire plot all at once.
Right.
But it's very quickly just like, let us give you a really quick story that has nothing to do with it. And yet, here it all is.
Well, do you know what's funny? When I first started rereading this, like I'd listened to the audiobooks before and had sort of read this before. And I like reading this chapter because I'd gone a little further ahead in the chapters. Starting off this chapter, I'm like, okay, who are the Druins? Like, I don't understand. Like, I was trying to place what significance to the entire story that they held. And like, honestly, very little.
Very little.
Which is awesome.
They're a fun family, though.
Right?
They really are.
Absolutely. They,
like, every single one of them is a character, quite frankly.
Totally. And I love all the references, even from the beginning. He talks a lot about, some usually the ones who wear a lot of black and think that Byron must have been mad, bad, and fabulous to know. Dream of tenebrous graveyards in the shades of monstrous Gothic churches. I mean, he spends a lot of time talking about the burial grounds and like the Druin family themselves. And
right. We are given a great descriptor of the Grimpen burial grounds. Awful, depressing, a formerly malaria infested marsh.
So I was reminded, when I first read the book, again, this was like a while back, like I was still in high school or something like that, maybe even middle school at that point. And my original mind's eye was like a bog, really. And just like, you know, people buried in the marsh and that was that. But the second time rereading, I was like imagining a cemetery and, you know, a little bit more traditional burial ground. Right. So trying to mold these two pictures together, I'm like, okay, a really, really, really shitty burial, which is, I guess, essentially what he wants you to picture.
Totally.
But
I like, too, that he goes through all the different burial processes. Like, you know, there was one statement of others would like a tree to be planted over their otherwise unmarked graves so that their bodies might nourish the roots of a mighty oak. That actually made me laugh, not just because, not the writing itself, but like, isn't that how we get haunted forests?
You want haunted forests? That's how you get haunted forests.
I mean, that thought always has appealed to me on a personal level of, you know, having a tree grow out of my remains. But at the same time, I'm like, yeah, do I choose a willow or like, what is the creepiest?
Right.
I love that it does go through all the different ways that people imagine their burials with the, like, there are quite a number of different ways that he describes that.
Good old dead people tea.
But then we get the reason. Then we get the reason people wanted to use the Grimpen burial grounds. Perhaps they hated their relatives and wanted to drag them into one of the ugliest and most depressing places on earth, if only for the funeral.
If only for the funeral.
Serves you right.
Yeah. The interestingly, how the Grimpen burial grounds are described, surrounded by a bog and mists, and the burial ground was closed because it was full. Now, I did a little bit of research on the Grimpen burial grounds, and it is actually a nod to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Hound of Bakersville, which mentions a Grimpen Mire, which is basically where this is all set. Which also is a nod to real life, Fox Turin, or it has a real life counterpart that people theorize.
Oh. Interesting.
That's cool.
Pull out your Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah, we get a lot of classical literature references within these books. That's which true. I am so
we had Telltale Heart in the short stories.
Yes. Totally. Well, and that's part of, like, you start reading this book and you end up having to, what was that meme that you just showed me today? It's like you start reading a book and...
You want me to read a book just so I can understand other books? Sounds like a pyramid scheme.
Right? I think that's an appropriate meme for today.
Yeah.
And for this writer, essentially.
Well, we were talking, Amber and I were talking about... preparing for these books, that we almost need to do a reading on Lovecraft and a lot of older English historical.
Yeah, start brushing up on our turn of the century witchcraft fictions.
Yeah. Right.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah. Right.
References, totally. There's even, this is a little bit more modern of a reference, but when he's describing the Druins, I was thinking of the Dread family at Disney Parks.
Hmm.
You know, the Haunted Mansion has this whole, like, it's got this, the Dread family, it's made up of six people, and it's, like, essentially, like, they all murdered each other to try and get the family inheritance. So, like, Disney's got, like, these, like, you know, head busts, and you've got, like a rhyme or paragraph or something like that on the bust, and you're supposed to read them and then figure out who killed who, right?
Hmm.
But it's, like, I almost got the same vibes from this. Like, they're just such kooky characters, and they were all just so horrible. There's a quote in there somewhere else. It's, like, philanthropy... was crossed out of the family dictionary.
Yes. Oh, I have that down. Yeah, I wrote that down. I thought it was hilarious. Mills and railways were heavily invested in. Children sent down mines. The word philanthropy carefully crossed out in the family dictionary.
Yeah, so.
And the Druins became richer and richer and richer. So, yeah. And then it was like, yeah, it was about then that the effects of great wealth and a small gene pool started to spell their doom.
Oh, my God. This is the best line.
Isn't that how all good lineages end, really?
Well, and I find this is about where the short story part begins. Right after we have the description of the cemetery, where we are introduced to the Druin family. The family muddled through the centuries, frequently backing the wrong horse in a multitude of conflicts, yet always managing to get into the winning side at the last through some dazzling act of treachery. Richard III is rumored to have known he was doomed when the Druins defected to the House of Lancaster, actually during the battle, was reported to him. He made some comment about rats and sinking ships before going off to look for his horse.
It's a resourceful family.
Right?
And
play both sides. It's safer that way. It's safer
that way. I got to respect the hustle.
Don't hate the game.
If you're going to hustle player, Richard the game. III, man, you know how to play that game. Yeah. Do you ever?
Well, depends on the gene pool, I say.
Yeah, at least it's not quite watered down yet.
Particular gene pool.
We get such great descriptor of this family throughout, and like just their ultimate demise being like... synchronous with their odd passions.
Yeah, each of their hobbies and, you know, exactly, careers.
Oh, but before we get to that, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because, like, the paragraph after that, and I hate to quote so close to each other, from the
Plantagenet.
From the Plantagenet years onward, the Druids were said to be capable of swapping from Protestant to Roman Catholic and back again with the period of a single church service. Indeed, a secret library was discovered during the renovations of Druid Manor, contained a copy of the Catechism, the Bible in Greek, Latin, and English, a treatise on Calvinism, the Quran, the Triptaka, an Arabic book bound in a curious leather that was later stolen by a gang consisting of an antiquarian, a mobster, and a woman with a lisp.
Oh, that's right. You told me you did some research on this.
I did.
Do it.
The research that I did, and if you're interested in learning more, look to our website, necromancers.ca, and look in our posts, because it describes who the gang is. But the book is supposed to be the Necronomicon. And this is revealed by Jonathan L. Howard himself in a question period during Goodreads session.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And the gang, you'll have to go to our website to find out more.
I guess I will. Do I get to know?
Click here for more information. No, that was really cool. Like, that's actually funny. Isn't it also that in that Jonathan L. Howard says that he should have created an annotated version, or he should create an annotated version of this book?
Well, here's a hint. He's a gamer.
There's a lot of references, like external references. Yeah,
absolutely.
Right?
There's a couple that I have. We are going to nail down an interview with you, Jonathan. And I have questions.
Don't tell him our intentions.
I have questions.
Kidnap, stuff in a body bag, ship back to Canada.
We are not trying to steal the author. Please do not interpret anything we say as such.
We just want to ensure that next book finally gets published.
Right?
I don't know if Jonathan L. Howard is a royalist, anti-royalist.
Okay.
But I would guess he is, based off of his other political commentary from his Twitter. But I totally get a little bit of, like, you know, dragging of the royals in this kind of defense of the Druids as well, you know, this incestuous inbreeding and overly rich and
well, it's a familiar story.
Sidestep. It's a familiar story very much. But the legacies. It just seems so much like
royal lineages and legacies are rife with trying to protect your assets through family love.
Yeah.
This is nothing new.
And as good Brit, he probably will never actually tell you his
fact. they're more more diplomatic than Canadians, even.
Yes.
So
yes, you'll find a political way
diplomatic
of saying
is a word.
Polite.
And we'll have to actually look up all the words he says to actually figure out what the hell he just said,
right?
What?
But I did appreciate, like, how the Druin family, each of the Druins, met their ultimate end. In one case, it says Beatrice built the Museum of the Legume. Horace made a huge, I didn't quite understand this, a huge jelly mold, the inverse palace of Westminster. And Jeremy formed a hunt of foxes for beagle hunting. Ultimately, Beatrice later dies hanging from a chandelier, stuffed full of peas down her throat, forced down her throat. Jeremy's head is found on a plaque in the trophy room. Horace's shattered body is found at the peak of the inverse Westminster Tower, 300 feet below ground. I just thought that was hilarious. Like, you know, and it's funny because it literally takes you, I had to flip back and forth to see those connections in the pages of the book, because it's like, oh wait, each one of those was really ironic. Like, each one's death actually really coincided with their weird passion project for their life.
And I've got a note about it too. And, you know, as we come to discover, the reason that all the family members are being killed off is because they all tried to kill off this one member of the family, Aunt Sophia first, right?
Right. Mm.
And so part of the reason that they're all dying off is because they all tried to kill Sophia.
Well, but that's unproven. That's unproven.
You know, I've got a note though. And I'm like, it said something along like, she suffered a series of accidents, all of them fatal. Several times she was declared dead. As misfortune, sometimes embodied as a plummeting sack at blah, blah, blah. It goes on to the different things that tried to kill her.
Yeah.
But I've got one note and I'm just like, well, when you have that many gods, if you piss someone off, you've got to expect 300 lightning bolts are coming at you. If you're going to believe in God and Zeus and
right.
all of these other ones, then yeah, if every single one is mad at you, they're all going to take their chance to take you out.
And I wondered about her death, like her actual, like the death that she doesn't, quote, rise from, at least for
2 months.
2 months?
It was 2 months, which is remarkably fast, honestly, for a flattened body.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
A steamrolled body.
How do you manage to wake up from the last case, which is 4 tons of explosive and a steamroller? How does one use both? Do you steamroll her and then blow her up? Or do you blow her up and then steamroll her?
This might be too dark for dinner.
Well, it's okay because Sophia was always back in time for tea.
Right, exactly.
Yes. Like a true Briton.
Elevensies.
Always yeah. ready for elevensies. That's hilarious. I just love that eventually, what was it? The loofah lady.
Yes.
Yeah,
not only does all of the family members die, but now there's a rash of childhood anemia cases. And then we get the with the strange curse of the anemia, you get the dreams of going to a bathtub with the woman in the bathtub. And the horror, the shouting, the loofah lady.
Yes.
The loofah lady.
All Which fear is, the loofah lady.
Again, yeah. as they finally thought they'd killed Sophia. They buried her in her bath,
right?
And then they have this comment. They're like, if only someone had gone to check on the woman in her bath. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, only if.
Maybe. Hey.
Yeah.
I know I generally go through. And again, they had an issue with Sophia coming back to life. But I was like, nothing in the world would get me to go into a crypt to double check the body's still there. Like,
right.
But isn't this what we were saying earlier when I was talking about technical problems? That, you know, like it's like the demon that you think you've solved it and like... Just don't turn your back because there's probably more going to attack you any second now, or it's inevitably going to rise up regardless of whether you killed him 10 minutes ago or not.
That's a fair point.
You know, like the loofah lady, she just comes back and nobody ever looks over their shoulder.
Something inevitable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're just taking this as reality. Okay.
But yeah, so we get a nice descriptor of the entire. So, yeah,
that's burial. Essentially them. But that's it.
Like, welcome to the Druids.
Thanks and for the part.
That's the end of it.
Curtain closes.
That little section closes that the case's anemia stop 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And then we are next provided with information of Johannes visiting the Grimpen burial grounds.
Yes. 8 years later, after the burial ground has mostly been forgotten by time, Johannes pays a visit, heading to the Druid vault with only a carpet bag and an uncomfortable crow on his shoulder. So Cabal enters.
There's a moment just before that when he trips over a telephone wire, and like he like doesn't pick it up and doesn't inspect it because it's gross. I was like, thank you. I'm so tired of people like constantly dipping their hands in blood to check things. Like, yeah, things on the ground are gross, and you should walk over them.
Don't
like,
touch that.
Yeah.
I'm going to quote that really quickly mm-hmm. because I am going to do a call upon our audience, because this is another reference that I haven't been able to research and find out. At least.
Is this the phone box?
I think it is.
Is this the phone box? Okay. See, Johannes, I have a different theory on this.
Okay. One. Johannes trips on something. It was an old army surplus field telephone box. Its wooden box in advanced state of decay, and he did not care to touch it. The Bakelite handset lay discarded by it, and the telephone wire itself led, Cabal discovered after a moment's investigation, down into a tomb whose lid had been slightly moved. Cabal distantly remembered seeing this box on his last visit. He pursed his lips and straightened up. The abandoned field telephone doubtless had some weird tale associated with it, but he really didn't have the time or inclination to find out what.
Okay.
I really want to figure out what this is. I think this is a nod to another book.
Okay.
But I have
Did you get
no
anything deeper out of this, Jess? You have no clue. Sorry, what?
I have no clue. Like the research that I did when you're looking into field telephone boxes and cemeteries yields to nothing but Flanders Fields.
Right.
So.
Any thoughts, Jess? I don't think it's a big deal. I don't think it's a thing. I think it's just more descriptive fluff.
I don't know. If it's something that he noticed beforehand and he's noticed that it's now changed,
But where is the reference from? Like, is it from another book? Is it from another cabal book?
I've never read a book before, so I wouldn't be able to tell.
Who invited her to this podcast?
I just live here.
I host because they make me. I don't actually read the things.
I own a mic, so I am here.
I know how to talk good.
Do I?
This is why they keep
me around.
I don't
think that I do. Do things are maybe better now that we've been recording for a year, but like in our first few episodes, I was always saying, like, I just focus on one word and I'd say that word 80 times in that episode. And I'd be like, okay, say basically one more time, you idiot. Like,
Druin.
Yeah. So then, and so then, so then,
so then,
so then,
so then,
so then.
Well, you get to re-listen to it and you learn from it.
Yeah.
So. Well, and if
we're doing awesome, I think.
There's always Tans and who works her editing magic. So, you know,
it's true. I she makes make me say
basically
smarter.
20 more times.
I like that. I'm going to scratch that in a little bit more.
Loop the so then.
Yeah. So then, so then, so then, so then.
We can make our own podcast tune.
What was the olden days when you used to like people's speeches used to get turned into like hip-hop raps and things like that? Politicians are always turned into those.
Yeah.
Just beatbox our own podcast.
You wanted to get a little creative with things, didn't you, Tansen?
We were really excited with the episode being less than 1 hour, so we wanted it to actually be six.
No, this is relevant and on task.
Absolutely. No scope creep here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so regardless of whether or not the telephone box is important. Cabal.
Well, we're putting it out there. If anybody can solve this riddle for us, there's a special something for you in return. How's that?
Yeah, we'll figure out what magical thing you're going to get.
We resurrect your dead cat.
Yeah. just in case.
We'll replace your dead goldfish.
Insert something magical for somebody who finds the answer.
Free sticker. Free sticker for anybody who can figure this shit
there
out.
We
How's
go.
That?
I like that.
We'll get there.
Just don't mind if it's got a beer bottle and a skull in it.
We'll have new stickers by
then. I'll get on it.
So Cabal makes his way into the burial grounds, regardless of whether or not telephone boxes are important.
And he goes into the crypt to meet the thing.
Yeah, he takes his key ring and then locks the padlock from the gate. And then he says to himself, it pays to invest in quality, he thought. And, you know?
Was that a comment on the lock?
Yeah. That was the comment on the lock.
Okay.
Because he had been there before and he had used
He's
this
the one who
shiny,
locked it.
He locked
right.
it. There's two locks there. One that had been sawed. And then the second one that he had put on with the stainless steel and it was impeccable condition, which that's why he says to himself that it pays to invest in quality. And to me, I think, really, you're thinking that when you're about to
unleash a beast?
Unleash who this is once we find out who it is.
It's all just a dick.
Oh.
But at the same time, dick. I have to also really agree with him. It really does pay to invest in quality.
He's pragmatic. It's not dick-like. It's
he's
pragmatic.
Dick. And the fact that he always refers to it as an it and a thing. Just a dick.
Okay, but who is referring to it? Is it the narrator who's referring it to as an it or a thing? And let's be honest, it is an it or a thing. It is not a man.
Well, and it's the questioning the humanity.
Yes.
Because he's not sure at this point,
I heavily disagree with you.
The thing coughed gutturally as if making its throat work for the first time in years. So it's obvious that this quote-unquote thing has been here a while. So like, okay, if you've been locked up for 8 years, you're a little mad.
Yeah. Right?
I'd sing to myself. I'm probably sure I've gone mad.
Yeah, you didn't even need to be locked up.
It just sing happened to myself naturally. Anyway, it's all good.
It just happened naturally.
Yeah, no, that would be an insane amount of time to go without any stimulation of any sort.
Right?
Like
all but the spiders.
Spider races, yeah.
Oh my god, that made me so fun. That made me laugh so hard.
The two catch up, and it's fun, you know. What's up with you? How long has it been? 8 years, that sucks.
Well, Johannes, with that conversation, admonishes, it's like it's a child before they even have that conversation.
Well, and okay, he walks in there guns blazing, saying, like, figuratively speaking, and saying that, okay, now I've got a proposal for you. So, like, it's obvious this thing has been locked down there for 8 years and 3 months or 27 days or whatever it was. He's not very happy about it, and in walks Cabal, not offering necessarily a cure, but, you know. Well, oh, yeah, I have a proposal.
Yeah, right off the bat, he's like, if you're going to have an attitude, then I'm going to leave. Bitch!
Right?
Give him a minute.
Well, then we hear of Cabal's mistake. Like, ultimately, he was the one who led this thing being trapped in this crypt. And essentially, this made me laugh. You were the one with the almanac. This is the thing referring to Johannes. How could you make a mistake like that? The clocks had gone forward. I hadn't reset my watch. It was a simple oversight. Daylight savings strikes again. For a fellow hater of daylight savings time, I can actually, I get this.
Part of me actually wondered if this is the scientific mind wondering what would happen if he let the time lapse.
Ooh.
I was going to say, it seems to me purposeful as well.
Really?
Because yeah, he's yeah. not the kind to make that mistake.
Well, no wonder you think he's a dick.
He is so meticulous.
I'm like, come on now, that's my boo you're talking about.
He has that response really prepared.
Yeah.
It is. It's so fast. And yeah, he doesn't make mistakes like that. Like, he knows. And also, he's got people whispering in his ear every night at 4 a.m. He should know when to set his clocks. Hey, you're an hour late today. I guess I should change
Although,
my clocks.
By that time, he had managed to abolish the time setters.
Well, that's really interesting that time becomes a recurring theme, like throughout sort of a lot of these stories as well, right? Like,
I think a necromancer is always running out of time or trying to make more time.
The one commodity you can't recreate.
Right? Mm-hmm. Well, and if you think about it, like, death is the ultimate race against time.
Fact. Mm-hmm. Well, and in regards to what you were saying about the human versus, you know, the thing, it's like Cabal says, I'm only human, in reference to like his mistake of overlooking daylight savings. The response from the thing is, how nice for one of us.
Yeah, right.
So like, it's obvious that the thing itself does not see it as itself as human necessarily.
To a certain degree, I would say I agree with that. But I also would say, like, it's just another dig. Like, you got me in this spot. Fuck you.
Right. I'm the monster you created, sort of thing.
Exactly. You know, like, whether or not even, like, if I think, you know, there's a difference between believing it of yourself and putting the blame on someone else, you know?
Right.
Like, not to say that he doesn't believe it in both ways.
So it's more of a cheeky F
you. I think it's, you know, both. Yeah. It's also like, oh, yeah, are you human? Nah.
Yeah. Thanks for one of us. Yeah. Screw you, buddy.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, okay.
Right. But at the same time, not necessarily abandoning it for himself. It's hard to say at this point in the game where they fall. And like you said, it could just be the narrator's opinion and leave it at that. And I think it's fair to say that both Cabal and the thing don't know for themselves how, I mean, when you've lived your entire life in this crypt, it's hard to know exactly where the monster begins and ends.
Right.
For him, right?
Yeah.
But to a certain degree, I think that he would also be like, well, I mean, there's a moment when he doesn't even know if he has a reflection, because he's always been in a crypt. He hasn't looked in a mirror in 8 years, right? So he's like, I don't know. Do I have a reflection, right? So I think it's not fair to say what does he know about himself? Because, yeah, locked in a box for 8 years, monster or not, I'd be a monster.
Who am I?
Yes. Yeah, like, I would be crazy.
Totally. And here's where we see it. He's been down in the crypt for 8 years and 37 days. I stand corrected.
Why the cases of anemia have stopped, perhaps?
Ha-ha.
Oh.
Yeah. I like the, you'll find somebody for me regarding the thing being hungry and Cabal offering to procure him a meal. Have you any idea how cheap that makes you sound? From amateur necrologist to pimp, you've come up in the world. Necromancer, Cabal regretfully corrects. And that's when the thing becomes more aware of his sacrifice to become a necromancer as well.
You fool. Ha ha ha.
Ha ha ha.
Well, and there's quite a bit of familiarity there.
Right?
Because the thing seems to know the results.
His history.
Yeah. The thing knew about Johannes' plan to become a necromancer by selling his soul. Mm. And not only that, the thing also works out that Johannes is also trying to wager to get his soul back. He's sort of backwards analyzed this whole situation. So he's very smart.
He's very smart.
Well, he hasn't a lot of...
Totally smart.
Hasn't had a lot of input over the last 8 years and 37 days. He's probably listening pretty careful and knows the back history for sure.
He knows the back history, but he doesn't know that Johannes has come back or is going to... He seems really genuinely shocked that he actually did sell his soul to get the power of necromancy.
So do you know the difference between necrologist and necromancy, or is this just another sort of, did we ever look that up?
I think we discovered that it was a theory.
Whereas Mansur is more the practice?
Theory versus practice. A research of ideology, like a theologist versus a scientist.
So like a theoretical physicist versus an actual rocket scientist or something.
Yes.
Okay.
That's how I took it.
All right. All right.
What we discussed was the
rocket technician, I should say.
The having such little knowledge about this that he and the being quite the type A personality and wanting to categorize everything.
Giving your own title.
That he gave himself his one? Own title mm-hmm. because it was such an unknown realm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, it seems like that he was sharing it with the thing.
Right.
Right.
Little inside knowledge.
Yeah.
And there's another, you know, small hint here, too, where he's like, well, I thought you failed. It's been so long. What have you been doing this whole time? And Cabal's like, well, I haven't tried yet. It's like, ooh, what are you talking about?
Right. I think that's very important information. Yeah. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. If you haven't actually read anything further, make a note of this in your brain, because this is subtle information that you'll want to come back to.
And so important, too, that it's like, you know, this thing knows about it, even that, right? Because it's one thing to know someone's backstory on a, like a career level. Like, it's one thing to know his backstory, but know, like, okay, you're a necromancer. Like, as far as, like, you know, with the cop we met in the short story, he might just know that, right?
Right.
But this guy is like, no, like, I know your plans and your goals, too. So it's like, that's even more. It's
definitely more of an intimate knowledge of each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the banter in this. There's one point where the thing says, the last time I helped you, I ended up with an extended tenancy in somebody else's crypt. You know, I don't feel really motivated to help you again. And Johannes's response is, I think you should. The thing responds, what, help you or feel motivated? I actually laughed out loud at that. I feel like I want to say that at some point to somebody. You know, like next time they say you should feel motivated to assist.
I like
you know
that. What I'm yes.
saying. Right.
At which point this is when Cabal's like, all right, I guess we'll start with the bribery.
Right.
And starts offering up the cure.
Totally.
He is honest that he, when he's asked point blank, though, that
he's going to try.
That he will try.
Yes.
That he doesn't necessarily have the cure, but that he will make an honest effort towards it.
And I think it's fair to say that he's would probably be in a better position because he says, he's like, I believe that your disease has to do with the soul. And I've spent a lot of time working on those lately, which is, I think, is a fair claim. I don't think that's an overly grandois assumption of his own capabilities.
Grandois.
Grandois? Is that the word?
Grandiose.
Grandiose.
I love you. I think if you say it like grandois, it's even more fancy. Know. It's totally more fancy.
Don't worry, I'm not going to edit any of that.
No, I don't. Love it. I just read. I don't say things out loud.
So he's very direct in saying he doesn't necessarily have the cure, but, you know, he's going to do what he can. And he also, this is the point at which I think we hear him tell of his recent acquisition, ownership of the carnival. And the thing is disbelieving. And one of the quotes I loved, with all the best will in the world, Johannes, you're as much fun as a leper at an orgy.
Why are your why are all your similes sexual? It's always annoyed me. You've answered your own question.
Right?
Total.
I missed that.
Total, yeah.
Perfect banter.
Yeah.
Perfect, perfect banter. And as we get a little more of that intimate knowledge that you were talking about as well, where this is like a wager, like, you know, he tells him about the wager that he's made to have this carnival. A wager, well, wonders never cease. You don't bet. You're no fun. This doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Like, this is obviously somebody who knows Johannes quite well.
Totally. Right? And this is another moment where he's smart, too, because he quickly deducts who this wager would be with. And it's fun how he just, like, instantly is like, what's the quote exactly? Like, that's a...
Somebody with a sense of irony. Oh, yes. The thing realizes that the wager was made by somebody with a sense of irony, or at least a sense of petty sadism.
Petty sadism. He's like, oh, God. Yeah.
Totally.
He doesn't wager to lose. He wagers to win.
Totally. Which is another, like, Cabal's like, I know that, but I only had, that was my only choice anyways. And it's such a, you know, Cabal overconfident, like, well, somebody's got to beat him. Might as well be me. And if it's not, I was already screwed. Like, fair enough, I guess.
Which is interesting when you look at the petty sadism as well. Like, this is also when I've got the note for the spider races. Right? So it's an interesting juxtaposition because he's essentially talking about a wager with a petty sadist like mm-hmm. Satan himself. And yet the highlight of the thing's captivity was the spider races. He used to eat the losers, then I'd eat the winners so he wouldn't get cocky. You know, like,
it's a good metaphor.
Really good.
It's a real good metaphor.
Right?
Yep. It's a nicely timely placed metaphor.
Totally.
I have to say that I am really appreciative that Jonathan L. Howard is able to bring a level of sort of common humanity to these characters. Like, less so with Johannes, but the side characters.
Yeah.
So the thing, we don't know what it is yet. Like, we have an idea, but we have this sort of humanity that comes towards
everybody is humbled and it. Humanized.
Even Satan himself, that we've discussed before, has this level of, you know, he plays bridge. that's so he's much more common than we would think.
Absolutely. Well, and I think here's where we also get introduced to Cabal's humanity and his vulnerable nature, because like then he gets into his full what the thing later calls his you know, loser's speech, where Cabal proclaims, and if I fail, it won't be through lack of will or defeatism setting in. I'll be able to look Satan in the eye and say, I did my best and it came pretty close. And while you just sat here on your fat sulfuric arse, I stretched for the impossible. So don't imagine for a moment that this is your victory, you smug infernal bastard. I think it's hilarious that the gracious loser's speech was all worked out in advance. So, like, right. This is what the thing points out, right?
Well, and that's not the only point that we get this sort of humanity from Cabal.
Yeah.
That little inkling, that little hint. Because he also has that memory recollection of when...
8 years and 37 days ago?
Yes. Of when he was running in fear. True. And all he could hear is, Johannes... help me, help me, help me.
Right.
And that is presented in a way that's sort of like that pang in the heart.
It's true. Mm-hmm. It's true. And we see the remorse from that section as well. Like, yes. He obviously regretted his choice, right? Mm-hmm. Whether he's going to admit that now or not.
Well, I think vehemently he will not.
Yeah, he did walk around the topic.
Yeah.
There was another moment, though, another metaphor where in his loser's speech, he's essentially trying to corral the thing into also not just sitting on his ass and letting the rest of the world go by him, you know? He's trying to coax him and being like, yeah, you should come and join me and help me or else you're going to be stuck here and I'll get to, you know, give my loser speech to you as well, you know? But it's, again, a little bit of that metaphor on the opposite side is like, you caused this, you know, winners mm-hmm. or losers. Everyone's losing.
One of the things that I was surprised of is that when Cabal does ask the thing for its help, he apologizes for leaving it behind. He does. He actually takes that moment.
So it's not 100% pride and hubris. Like, let's be honest.
He does have just a glimmer of social understanding, enough to be, I think, humorous in these books, and not enough to be humorous in this book.
I go 50-50 on it because I think, you know, you can be very, you know, prideful to a fault. You can, you know, have hubris as your downfall. Any of these things at the same time regret it when it's thrown back into your face. I mean, sure. You know, just because you didn't mean for the consequences to necessarily go the way they did doesn't mean that, you know, you didn't do steps A through Z that got you there, you know?
True. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm a little bit 50-50. You know, you can be regretful of your idiocies, but you still did them.
Totally. Well, we get a little more into the character development when the thing starts talking about the concessions and Kewpie dolls. Of course, by this point, Cabal has Johannes has said, like, you know, we've got this carnival and I ultimately can't do it without you. Which, again, I think shows a bit of weakness, a bit of vulnerability there for Cabal. But it really shows that Johannes has no idea, like, probably didn't have much of a childhood, mm-hmm. you know, like, fairs just weren't his thing.
Didn't see the point.
Yeah, and I love the thing's response. You're going to have to rewrite your loser's speech, Johannes. Get rid of the bit about coming pretty close. You haven't the faintest idea what you're doing. So, and this is where he explains that he really needs, you know, the creature to assist, and costs are covered.
Which is my biggest thing here now, okay? He's come to this monster, whether we just refer to the narrator or Johannes as the thing, as it. And he comes to this monster, he's like, I need someone who understands the humans. Like, you're coming to a monster that for the humanity of it?
That's a really great point.
Like, that's my big annoyance that he keeps referring to it as it. And maybe, okay, fine. Maybe it's just the author. But for me, he just keeps referring to it as an it. And he's like, I need you to understand the humans for me.
See, but that's the big reveal, right? That's essentially why I think part of the reason I saw it as a short story as well in terms of the wrap up, because like
slightest red herring, this whole,
you know, you're envisioning some sort of creature, some sort of bog, stenchy something.
He says, and, yeah, for most of the story, he says he walks like a spider up until he gets dressed.
Yeah.
Well, and then JHL. What would his reasons for doing that would be? Like, why would he actually to make this juxtaposition between the monster asking the monster for help on humanitarianism? Is that to reflect Cabal or to humanize the monster?
Oh, that's one thing. Is like, first of all, juxtaposition is just a nice story element, but I think it is a little bit more like blunting of the monster rather than Cabal, because personally I think, you know, Cabal is very much affected by the world around him, like you said earlier, like all the people around him, Satan or the Mr. Bones or the monster here, like everyone seems to have a touch more humanity than Cabal ever does, a touch more realism, common man, than Johannes at least projects in himself.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like every time I read this story, it's like the rest of the world is almost like, you know, they're almost living like their normal lives. And then Cabal's always like, ugh, the whole world, ugh, I'm a necromancer. Nobody understands. And the rest of the world's like, dude, like, we're just getting our groceries. Like, yeah, you're chill the for like a minute. Like,
but I think
it's
that's
not so dramatic.
I think that's really interesting character development, though, because again, it's not that one dimensional. Like, who is the monster? Like, I love stories that have me question who is the bad guy. That's I don't want my bad guy. Yeah, I don't want my bad guy wearing black and being obvious. You know, like, I want my bad guy to show some good sides to himself,
too. The bad guy always thinks that he's the hero of the story.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's like, you look at reality, and I think we talked about this in another episode at one point, where it's like, you look at the reality, and nobody is that one-dimensional. We all have our inner monster. Some of us just pull it out and show it, and some of us are actual real-life monsters. Mm-hmm. But does that mean that they are any less human, right? Like, obviously, before this thing was a monster, clearly it had much more charisma and understanding and empathy and compassion for humanity than Johannes perhaps ever will.
It's a common trope in fantasy, sci-fi, these sorts of things, when non-human entities are always like shitting on humans, and they're like, the fact you can just go to war with yourselves is insane and barbaric and whatever, right?
Yeah.
But obviously in our world, where we only have humans as far as we know, we're like, yeah, no, that is all human on human violence. Like, we can never say, oh, that was a werewolf. Oh, that was a fairy. Oh, that was a necromancer. Like, we're like,
yeah. No, that was Jim.
Literally was just Jim. Yeah.
Yeah. human behavior is not always that humanitarian.
Yeah. So oh, exactly. I think, you know, when you're reading a book like this, when you can have a legitimate monster in your story, it is something to remember that, you know, the humans are the original OG.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Monster.
Absolutely.
So the thing agrees to run the carnival.
Well, Johannes explains that he needs the thing, and all the costs are covered, including annual taxes. And despite their reputation for tenacity, I doubt even tax collectors will descend into the infernal pit just to collect the revenue. Coming out of a recent business situation, I thought that was hilarious, because I can actually see that.
They've clearly not dealt with the CRA.
Yeah, and this too. Incidentally, the carnival's sponsored by Satan, and we're far more interested in stealing 100 souls than in making money issue. It's like, I don't know how many accountants would be okay with that. Let's be honest. So yes, the thing agrees to help after he says that Johannes will try to reverse the condition that that besets him, and he will run Johannes's carnival for him. So here we learn of more how Johannes was mostly to blame for him being locked up.
Well, and Cabal requires at least one more assurance that he will not be harmed by the thing. and it threatens him that he could have easily dispatched him the moment that he came through the door.
Right? Like rushing up on him and then like throwing him to the ground, super speed, in like less than a breath.
Mm-hmm. So this is another hint to what the thing is. Because the Cabal provides clothes and toiletries and asks if it casts a reflection. We know that it eats corpses, spiders. It has super strength and speed and may or may not cast a reflection.
Yes, he said earlier on he ate all the bodies that were down here in the crypt.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he also says a little earlier, but despite everything, I'm a reasonable man. And I actually wrote a note that said it's interesting that he still considers himself human.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So again, we get back to that. Is he a man? Is he a monster?
Right.
Right? So he actually says himself, I'm still a reasonable man. Right?
Which is more questioning of humanity of himself than Cabal ever gives.
Totally. So yeah, the hints start coming and we start getting the idea that maybe this thing is more vampire in nature.
Mm. Yeah, the V word.
And another old legend bites the dust as, yes, the reflection is there. And yeah.
Can the thing just see his own reflection? Can anyone else see his reflection? I don't think enough science was done.
I think they're just trying to get out of the crypt without being noticed.
Move it along, people.
Yeah, we got trains to catch in the middle of the night here in order to get home.
And one more point to the vampirism is that they can only travel by night now.
So here's where I have a question. The thing asks to feed. Johannes gets scared of the infection. The thing explains that it has to be reciprocal. And he says, it's the blood mingling that spreads the infection. I just wish I'd thought of that before I tried eating Sophia. So here's my question on the timing and synchronicity of that. So was the thing a vampire before he went into the crypt? Or did he go down as a human? The thing attacked him somehow, Sophia attacked him. Somehow he got her down and then decided to eat her, and then Cabal locks him in?
See, and I put some thought onto
this
one.
What's the logical order of this?
My logic on this one is he was human when he went into the crypt with Cabal, and the thing that we know of was attacked by Sophia. Cabal ran screaming, locked them in. So he was attacked. I think that they had to sort of, he wasn't killed by Sophia because from the dialogue and repartee that we've observed that there, Sophia hasn't technically killed anyone, but her family who tried to kill her first.
Okay.
So it was this sort of.
She only wanted to feed on the children.
Yeah.
But once given the chance to, you know.
It's okay. So you and I were we head down to a crypt to kill this something mm-hmm. that has been attacking children.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, we manage to get into a tussle. You run out the door.
Mm-hmm.
You lock me behind with this creature, Sophia. I get it down, and somehow I decide to have a snack?
I don't think you get it down.
Not yet.
You don't get it down. Okay. She gets you.
She gets you.
Okay.
And she doesn't kill you because she doesn't kill innocent people. She just kills her family.
Yeah. So when she goes to sleep, the thing is like,
all right,
hungry.
Fuck you. Mm-hmm.
They've been locked in there. And I think the thing goes,
if it's
I'm
not
hungry,
you, it's me.
It's me or you and Sophia. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Because I was a little confused on like what, like there's not a ton of detail in terms of
I think that
how
brings
the scuffle.
It up that monster thing though too. Like maybe Sophia also didn't see herself as a monster. So she's like, I'm not going to kill you because you're not an innocent. I'm not a monster. I don't just kill people at random.
No, I got a new friend in the crypt.
Yeah,
oh,
like,
are you hungry? Eek.
But yeah. And then, yeah. So
yeah.
I basically take it as like, yeah, it was a mutual thing. And then eventually the thing was like, listen, shit's happening.
Right.
Enough time has passed now. And again, we don't know when he ate her. Maybe like 4 years, 5 years, six years. Or maybe it was a week one.
They may have been dining on the
snacking
the,
on each other for millennia? What? For years?
The other corpses that were in there.
Yeah, like they had the other corpses to go through and they had spiders.
Right.
But yeah, it's hard to say. Like maybe there was a while when they had a tryst for like 8 years or maybe like it was a weekend. And horse is like, oh fuck.
Maybe it was like a one-night vampire stand?
A weekend. And maybe the thing was like, listen.
Right.
Yeah. There's not enough crypt for the both of us.
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
Survivalist.
Mm-hmm.
See, because I thought he was locked in there for being a vampire. So I'm like, okay, well, then it doesn't make sense. If he's a vampire, they went into the crypt.
Yeah, I don't think Cabal tricked him
right.
trick the vampire into going into this vampire crypt. I think that, yeah, it was something like they were trying to figure out what was happening to the kids, or even like when Cabal said in that short story, like he wasn't trying to stop the hauntings happening at the theater. He just wanted to see and observe, you know?
Yeah.
So at if you this didn't point, deal, sorry.
He, at this point, you know, Cabal has heard whisperings of something going on. He thinks, oh, a vampire's life after death, that might have to do with my research. And he heads there. His friend or associate or whoever gets captured by a vampire. He's like, oh, I'm getting the fuck out of here now. These plans did not go good. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Like, I think, you know.
But see, if you didn't know, like, okay, so also in terms of that whole, you know, daylight savings time mucking us up, then would you even bother to check the almanac if you, like...
Well, this is
maybe again, you had some inklings that Sophia was a vampire. Well, maybe you just showed up to see what the hell was going on.
I think it was Cabal's inklings.
Way.
I think it was probably inklings.
He has scientific curiosity that, mm-hmm. and not enough.
Because they brought social... the padlock. Whether or not that's it was true. For the thing or for Sophia, they brought the padlock. There was a reason to lock at least empathy. One down there.
I don't think Cabal has enough empathy to actually have. Mm-hmm. I think he's scientific curiosity and not enough empathy to actually have. Wanted to save the thing.
Not to foresee right. the consequences of his actions.
That too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Point is, they eventually get back to their carnival.
Exactly.
At which point, introductions are finally made.
Yes. They make it to the carnival train, and Bones, Mr. Bones, has created some personnel of his own volition. And I love how Cabal wasn't sure if that was good or bad at first.
Can I... point out the right before we get to this part here, right? The thing tells Cabal it needs to feed. Cabal was looking to the Leech Gate and was obviously planning to run. The thing stopped following him and spread his hands. Look, what's bothering you? It's the homoerotic aspect, isn't it? Cabal was running. Well, don't flatter yourself, shouted the thing after him.
Already gone. I love it.
Totally.
I that one made me laugh so hard.
Absolutely.
Because it's that sort of vampire sexuality and sexuality thing.
He's at a moment in there too. He's like, I was a heterosexual before all this, but I'm not sure anymore.
Not sure anymore. Why are all the vampires bi?
You live for so long, you'll try anything.
Right? Why not? Why limit yourself?
Yeah.
Life's too short. Or too or long. Is it? Absolutely.
Yep.
So yes, we make it to
the two travel back to the train, and they do it at night because for no obvious sunlight reasons. And we find out that the train has been cleaned and repainted that black with the thin red line across the side of it.
Painted and pimped in his absence.
Yes. And that it's this thing of beauty and horror.
And so his traveling companion stops and laughs at reading the sign for the carnival, the newly painted sign.
Yes.
And Johannes admits the lost cause, that he would not have been able to do any of this without the help of the thing. And Bones introduces the world-renowned Cabal Brothers Carnival. And this is where we meet Horst.
Yes, we find out the thing is none other than Horst Cabal.
Indeed.
And they were brothers.
One of my all-time favorite characters throughout this entire series.
Oh, so good.
Welcome, Horst.
Horst is so fantastic.
And the series truly begins.
he's the lovelier brother, hey? Mm. He's the easier to like brother.
We've got the straight man and the comedic.
The duo is complete.
The best duo. Yeah.
Yeah.
This concludes our episode 3.3, The Thing from the Crypt. Thank you for listening. You can find us online at freeflowrambling.com and necromancers.ca. There we have links to our other podcasts, social media, and other fun tidbits. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing, and please consider supporting us through Patreon to keep the undead alive and to see more content. We are Free Flow Rambling, and remember, reanimation is trending.